Welcome to The Edges of Lean. I'm Bella Engelbach, and in this podcast, we explore the human and creative side of lean thinking, unusual places where lean thinking is practiced. We meet people who are practicing continuous improvement in many different flavors and styles. So come along with me on a journey to the edges of lean. Episode 13, Continuous Improvement and Improving Your Kaizen. When you've been practicing continuous improvement for a while, whether as an internal or external consultant, you follow your own advice and create standard work for yourself. You have an approach to training and an approach to coaching and an approach to Kaizen events. But what happens when your standard approach needs to be updated and improved? We can get as stuck in our ways as we see our clients being. My guest today is Peggy Fry Burns, who is just such an experienced operational excellence professional. Certified as a Master Black Belt, she has enjoyed working with operations and customer support teams in both financial services and technology. She's passionate about customer and employee experience and enjoys coaching teams, individuals, and small businesses towards continuous improvement goals. Peggy is sharing her journey of improving her own standard work for Kaizen. Peggy Fry, welcome to The Edges of Lean.
Thanks, Bella. It's great to see you again.
It's great to see you, too. And for those of you who are just listening, these recordings are also done on Zoom, so we always have video and we're looking at each other, so you can't see us smiling at each other, but here we are. So Peggy, when you first contacted me about being on the podcast and you said you wanted to talk about Kaizen, I was a little bit surprised because I thought, well, gosh, is that not really the edges of lean? That's, you know, it's a practice that almost everybody does. But you had this really interesting story about where you have been through your journey with Kaizen. And I do think it really takes us to the edges of lean. But before we get into that, I would love for you to tell us a little bit about Peggy and how did you get into the continuous improvement field?
So thanks, Bella. I think one of the things that might be different from in my story is that I started out in financial services in transactional processes. So my certification as a Master Black Belt was actually from Wells Fargo Bank, and my very first black belt project was in marketing. So transactional certifications often are, you know, very different when I talk to people than say, you know, the certification is the same, but how you apply the tools, it's not manufacturing, right? And the parts of it that I was really excited about at the time was the employee engagement in the operations and also the customer experience improvements. And that's primarily what we worked on. So I got the chance in my Master Black Belt certification to take lean training. And I enjoyed the workshops even more because you could get to the quick wins and still focus on customer experience and the employee engagement, actually, that aspect of it. So after I left banking, I went to work in tech in the Silicon Valley. And although it is technology companies, technology industries, I still was in the transactional part of it, customer experience, marketing, sales support. And so I've always worked in transactional services. And so I find that the services workshops work well for employee engagement, customer experience. And it really didn't matter if it was tech or financial services, I feel. In the past 3 years, I've actually gone into consulting. So I'm contracting now. I've worked on some large IT implementation projects. And again, the power of the engagement and the employee the getting to some quick wins. The business needs change, and you know they need it fast. So that's why I actually enjoy using the tools. I'm passionate that they work, first of all, and I really believe the employee engagement part of it, and I feel that that's so important. So
that's great, and I think it's really important for people who are interested in getting involved in continuous improvement, but think that you need to be an engineer or that you need to come out of manufacturing, to hear the stories of people, women especially, who get into it from different backgrounds, especially financial services. I think there's a lot of opportunity in financial services.
Yes.
Those of us, everyone has to use financial services. So I think we all have, you know, our points where we look for something even better than what we have now. So you've been doing Kaizen and Kaizen workshops for a long time. Tell us about, what was it like when you started doing it?
So the Kaizen workshops that actually, as I was trained on, we, as the practitioners, we were the facilitators, right? So we develop the agendas, and you know, if you've done Kaizen, is the number of years that I have, you probably have your favorite agendas and your favorite workshop formats that work over and over again. You know, if they're 5-day, 3-day, 1-day, whatever they are, you know, kind of thing. And so we would leverage these workshop formats and we would share them. And as you move from company to company, you could still kind of, you know, the basic Kaizen formats, you can translate to, you know, different industries. Go ahead.
Yeah, so you'd start with some mapping maybe and, you know, collect people.
Yeah, so, you know, obviously there's an understanding of the process, and a lot of the work is done, you know, well, obviously the work is done by the business team. So you're really, from the Kaizen perspective, you're really in a facilitation role. The one thing that I really found successful at Cisco, which is one of the examples that I was going to share, and other companies, the same thing too. The workshops actually were still prioritized. So this wasn't just kind of like pick something to go blitz. This was, you know, part of a prioritized list of projects that were queued and, you know, rated and ranked, and we had sponsorship, and that was all fabulous. The workshops and the Kaizen events actually were used for to get to some quick wins faster versus say a full project. And also we use the workshops from a training perspective, training the champions as the business process owners, training the teams on, you know, the tools, process mapping. They were already doing a lot of the work already and they just didn't know it because they didn't know what to call it, right, in terms of the tools. Yeah. And especially at Cisco, they had, you know, such a great culture for new product innovation. So for operation support, which we were for customers, we had to change our model quickly because, you know, Cisco did, I don't know, 10 to 15 acquisitions a year and we had to change the model. So that's why the workshops really worked well. I think, you know, within tech, of course, because they want everything faster, maybe they worked well within the Silicon Valley too.
So take me into one of those workshops. First of all, they were physical workshops, right? You would have them.
Yes. So when we started, again, you know, I'm sure everyone listening was trained on a Kaizen event format. And I had my favorite formats. And I worked for global companies. These were global tech companies. So you know, we would do a lot of, you know, as the facilitator, again, like I'm talking about, you know, this, my message is primarily to those who are practitioners, but they're facilitating the workshop. So you're organizing that body of work for the team and they're following your structure, even though they are the ones that do the work every day. So we would set up a format for the agenda. And there was a lot of pre-work and planning that was done. Of course, the process mapping. We did value stream mapping because a lot of our at at Cisco, a lot of the focus was on cycle time because it was related to case handling. And of course, you know, quicker is always better from a customer resolution standpoint. So we had our agendas that we would do as part of either, like I said, a larger project, or maybe we would be working on one specific process area because of a new product coming in, we had to change the model or you know, something like that. When we first started at both, when I was at Agilent and Cisco, we would always advocate to our sponsors that for the workshop portion of that project, everybody had to be face-to-face. And so you had a whole project around the logistics of just the workshop planning, right? Flying the team all in, getting the work, you know, the conference room organized, ordering lunch. Like there was like a mini project within the project, just getting the workshop organized, right? And, you know, so the good news of that is that it was an investment where, and, you know, as practitioners, we learned, right? People are setting aside their day-to-day work. They're not taking calls. They're not on the, you know, they're not on the phones. They're not working cases. And they really are, you know, focusing on that improvement activity. And that's, you know, that's why you could get to an action plan and, you know, start the implementation of some improvements and walk away from the workshop feeling like you had something that you could, you know, you could take action on, you would take action on, and there would be some improvement.
So you'd be getting,
go ahead.
You'd be getting focus. You'd be getting that team camaraderie, that sense of comfort with each other, you know, that people know each other where they might've only previously seen each other on a video conference or only heard voices on the phone. And you're getting that sort of intangible, but really important aspect of actually being able to handle the materials, right? That you can move the post-it note, that you could write a note on somebody else's post-it note, you can draw a picture on the wall.
Yes.
That was the stuff that, you know, I think you're right. Many of us were trained that way, and that was our expectation. I remember going into a room, and the first thing I would do when I look at a conference room is see if there are pictures hung on the wall, because if the pictures on the wall, ruined my conference room. You know, I wanted a wall that I could put my butcher paper on.
Right.
So gives you know, kind of gives you a different perspective of what should be in a conference room. So and obviously with all of that, you know, a lot of that has changed because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Yes. But there's something else that you were talking about being a facilitator that I think is really important to understand. And that is, you know, as you said, the work belongs to the team, right? They're the ones who have to go back and do the work in the new process once you've improved the process.
Right.
It is their work. They should understand their process. They should understand their data. But as facilitators, we often get kind of identified with the project, right?
Yes.
And I think you found that. So can you tell us like what happened in terms of things like project report outs in many of these instances?
Yes, that was exactly the problem, I will say. So as the facilitator, you possibly were also on the hook for the outcomes of the workshops. And part of that could be because, you know, you were investing this money in the travel, you were investing this time that you were pulling these people off of their day-to-day jobs and somebody had to cover for them or, you know, or else the work was going to get backlogged, that sort of thing. And so we, at least, you know, from I can say me and my colleagues at the time, we were always on the hook for these report outs to the executive sponsors. So we would write them up. And of course, it was all based on the team's input. But what I found was we actually started becoming the bottleneck because of the fact that, you know, the team wasn't really willing to share their work in progress. And so we were waiting on, you know, some update for statuses or something like that. You know, the write-up itself, we were focused on these 30-page executive summary type PowerPoint decks for our, you know, because these were our, you know, executive sponsors. And so that part of it became more of the, I don't know, overhead, if you will. It was like, you know, the workshop was fast, yet then the outcomes were moving actually without us in most cases. But what we were, what we, what, you know, my master black belt colleagues struggled with was, wait, how did we get in this situation where, you know, we were always the ones, you know, talking about the report outs to the sponsors? So we did, we talked to our sponsors. First of all, we changed a couple of things. We learned from that. We talked to our sponsors. And first of all, we told them, you know, this is going to have to be kind of like good enough. Nobody, none of our sponsors wanted this fancy 30-page PowerPoint deck. They were just, tell me what happened. You know, oh, by the way.
Why do you think people thought they had to do a 30-page PowerPoint?
Well, because it was going to an executive sponsor, right? Oh. And so, why were they uncomfortable sharing their results? Exactly. They were all doing great work. And, you know, we would hear things like, you know, well, that were they're too busy. Yeah, they were busy, but they were the ones sponsoring the event. They knew it was going on. So they weren't too busy to, you know, hear what the team had come up with, right? You know, we came up with one of the famous ones that I always heard was, well, it's 10% improvement, but I don't know, that maybe that's not good enough. Like, so what? Like, they're gonna say, so what, you know, kind of thing. And it's like, well, why don't we let them decide if it's good enough, right? We just, you know, report our results. We're trying to be neutral, you know? And the other one, I think that was kind of, there were many that were common, was that, you know, if we talk about budget reductions that we found, or we think we can reduce costs by this amount, then they're gonna take away my budget next year. And it's like, well, that could happen anyway. So wouldn't you rather be part of that conversation instead of, you know, like having it done to you kind of conversation? And I think overall, it was just this, this fear, this vulnerability of sharing, especially work in progress. Work in progress, I found, I don't know, it's like, it's not good enough yet. It's not done. It's not results. It's not validated. And maybe as practitioners, Bella, that was our fault, because we were all worried about the measurements and the validation of the process improvement. You know, maybe we focused on that part too much. And then the teams themselves were afraid of sharing work in progress, because, you know, what if this doesn't work, for example, right? Kind of like that fear of failure, or the fear of it's not quite ready yet, or it's not validated. So you
could look at a number of different reasons for that, right? I mean, you could imagine some of it comes out of training, particularly if you focus a lot on that in training, and you know, what are we going to do to demonstrate that we're in control, and what, you know, what are our metrics going to look like? Which obviously you have to run things for a while before you get those measurements anyway. But I'm wondering, did you ever share this with the executives? Did you tell how did the executives react to that?
So the executives at Cisco they agreed, first of all, that sharing from the teams was key. They wanted to hear from the teams. They didn't want to hear from us. They didn't want to hear from the facilitator. They wanted to hear from the teams. So, you know, we made a couple of changes. One of the things that Cisco was great at was they had a recognition event every year. So it was kind of like, we would encourage the teams, look, you know, you could write this up for the recognition event. The recognition event was well attended, well sponsored, a little bit of competition, you know, that sort of thing. So we were trying to make it fun. The one thing actually that Cisco had done was they had implemented an internet a Jive platform that we were, you know, supposed to use for communication type of thing. So we kind of started with that, like trying to make it easier. But honestly, you know, Bella, I hadn't figured it out yet. I mean, I still felt for the most part that, you know, the facilitators, the master black belts, were doing most of the write-ups, and our executive summaries got shorter. Maybe that was our benefit, because, you know, the sponsors were like, okay, give me 3 pages or 1 pages. So maybe we got better at that part of it. And I do think I, in my coaching, I do remember coaching the champions and the teams to present. So I think it got better, but I never, you know, for me personally, I just felt that it wasn't quite something that I had figured out, you know, when I left Cisco. And, I don't know that it was unique to Cisco. Cisco had great remote tools, virtual tools, you know, type of thing. In fact, one of my vice presidents actually challenged me when I asked, when I told her about, you know, I only do workshops that are face-to-face. And she's like, you know, you work for Cisco and you have all of these great tools. So you need to use the remote tools. So, you know, they did challenge us. And, you know, I mean, we, I, as colleagues, I think we just kind of felt, well, that's just the way that we work, right?
Well, I mean, certainly that's the way that I was trained, you know, that you get everybody together, you fly them in from all over the world and, you know, you do the workshop and that's the way that you do it. And, you know, as much as we live in a virtual world now, there's still some kind of magic to actually putting your hands on the materials.
Right.
You know, and we're learning to replicate that. But it's, you know, it's not quite the same, which maybe makes me sound a little bit old fashioned too, because I'm a big believer in you shouldn't have to get on the plane either. Right.
Yes.
Right. So when you're thinking about this and this kind of this role of the facilitator, it almost makes me wonder just in the structure of how lean or lean Six Sigma continuous improvement departments are placed in organizations, what people's beliefs are about those departments, and whether, you know, we talk about that the people in the workshop, that is their work, and they're going to go back and do their work once the workshop's over. But I wonder if we're almost saying something about who the work really belongs to or who the results belong to, even by sort of having departments and making it sort of a special thing that people do.
Right. And I think I have had several takeaways and still have takeaways. Like one of the things that I was thinking about was, and I've had the benefit of working at, you know, in multiple industries and multiple companies. So of course, the first thing you would say was, well, it's just the company culture that you happen to be in at that time, right? And that, I think that is a big part of it, but, you know, so as your role, you have to influence your sponsors wherever you're going. But what I found, Bella, was that it honestly didn't matter if it was like, you know, for example, when I left Cisco, I went to LinkedIn. So talk about a culture that's like talking about promoting what you're doing, right? And I still felt that these improvement teams had those same kind of like fears and vulnerabilities there in terms of especially sharing the work in progress. And, you know, I was just like, here I am again, I'm in this status reporting, you know, kind of role for my teams. And then in my contracting work, I have to say honestly that, well, you're getting paid to do the status report. So I guess you felt a little bit differently because it's like, all right, I'm just going to write them. It's just easier. And by the way, you know, I'm getting paid to do that part of it. So I think the culture is part of it. But what I've learned now is that it honestly didn't matter for me anyway. And if there's somebody out there that has a company that's doing all this the right way, please reach out to me because I would love to hear from them. But, you know, it wasn't necessarily just the company or the company culture or the way the work was organized, because this kind of fear, vulnerability, and that employee engagement, I felt it no matter what company I'd been working at, honestly. And so there's something there. And I feel that's the part of it for me now. I'm just convinced there that I can do a better job as a facilitator. In, you know, first of all, just recognize that that's real, right? Mm-hmm. And then I'm just going to put it in my workshop agenda. You know, it has to be part of that workshop. That communication has to be part of it. We do talk about at the master black belt level, at least, that these change management part of the project is just important as the tools. So let's walk the walk and let's make it that important, right? And let's put it in our formats, put it in our facilitation. That's kind of what I'm thinking.
So being really over about it, letting people know this is really important. So, but do you also talk about it might feel scary?
Oh, yes. That's the piece of it where, you know, you have to, I think maybe you have to be a little bit, you know, careful as a coach. When you're coaching for a certification, those conversations are, you know, always because the person is still in training kind of thing, you know, and I think that advisor mentoring role kind of has to be there. They have to be, they have to be careful with, or not careful, they have to be okay with you sharing stuff because, you know, they know you're talking to the executives, right? And then the executives have to understand that, look, this is a learning experience as well. Good enough is going to be good enough, and you're just going to have to accept it. So I believe that we're in a role of, you know, coaching the teams, of course, but also coaching our executives and the stakeholders in terms of, you know, what their expectations are.
When you and I were talking about the podcast, I shared an experience I had had at my former company, which was around project governance. And this was about, we actually wanted to change the way that project governance worked for the product development projects, not the improvement projects, but the projects that are going to be, that are coming up with new products for the company. Because that was actually an improvement for us, was to change the way that governance was looked at. So we realized that one of the things that was causing delay in product development was that people were getting senior level feedback late in the process, which resulted in a lot of rework. And so we said, aha, so the countermeasure we're going to apply is we're going to have this really nice, friendly senior level committee that a team can come to early in the process and just get all the years of wisdom, experience, and feedback that we want them to have now, as opposed to getting it, you know, close to the end when it would result in a lot of feedback. And this committee is going to be just a nice, relaxing, comfortable place to go. So we set this committee up. Now, I had most of the same people who were on the scary committees, but it, you know, but their role was they were going to be nicer. I'm not saying they weren't nice people, but they were going to be more advisory as opposed to directive with this earlier development committee. And we said to the teams, you don't need to come in with a massive amount of PowerPoint. You know, you probably have two or three important questions that you want to ask these very experienced senior leaders now. So, you know, so come in with enough information to, you know, to be ready to ask those questions. What did teams come in with? A massive PowerPoint presentation that they had spent weeks, worked late at night on. It was just so ingrained in them that mm-hmm. even though they had been told that that was not that kind of committee, they couldn't behave differently. And I'm wondering if you had those kind of experiences as well.
Yes, I definitely agree with you, Bella, that, you know, for, and again, maybe as coaches, we did part of that, right? Because as we're coaching in the certifications, it's all about the phases and presentation and, you know, you want to look good kind of thing. And then you go into workshop mode and, you know, it's more like, oh no, this is quick wins. It's good enough. Like, you know, take a picture of the whiteboard kind of thing, and that's fine. So we're sending mixed messages, right? We're sending mixed messages, and I feel like we get in our own way, because what we're really trying to facilitate is the team that's doing the work and has the ideas sharing the work and their ideas. And yet we as facilitators are kind of using these like, okay, here's the agenda and here's the format. And I honestly, Bella, I used to give my belts because they would ask me, I would just be like, okay, here, just use my format. And, you know, at least I could get them to start typing some of the stuff in. So I feel like we did that to them and we did that to ourselves. We almost need to, you know, as facilitators, I feel like we need to break our own mold of, you know, just copying these format. And, you know, part of it's like efficiency, okay. But, you know, if you had to start from scratch each time with like a presentation or a report out or whatever, you know, and it's all about leveraging the tools, but that's my learning. You need to kind of, if you could throw that all out and start over, what would you actually start with, right? Minimum viable product. Like, what do you,
yeah.
What's the minimum that you need for your communication kind of thing?
Definitely. I love that idea. So the MVP of the standard work that you need in order for the, you know, for the workshop or whatever event you're doing. It doesn't have to be a Cadillac.
And so my biggest learning, of course, this year, and I know many of the colleagues listening have probably similar stories or have been through the same thing. So, you know, of course, in March, I was part of an SAP implementation team, and we were face to face. We were doing all of our work. We were, you know, going to the site, all that good stuff. And then we weren't, because we were in lockdown, and 100% of our work moved to remote, to these virtual tools. And the company, the mining company that I was at, was using WebEx Teams from Cisco. So I was comfortable with the product, and, you know, but what I found fascinating was we were just starting user acceptance testing, which is a pretty critical phase of the, remember, talk about employee engagement. Like, you need to hear from the people doing the testing, right? And 100% of it was these daily posts and, you know, the daily defects. And they were telling me, and I was reading their notes, and they had to use the tool because we couldn't be on site. And so talk about work in progress. It was all work in progress, like all day long. And after a while, I would still do like my executive summary, but all of the updates were coming from the team, and they were coming daily, and they were coming fast.
And so the technology was actually helping to solve that problem.
It was. But the thing is that, you know, I'm not convinced, Bella, that was only the technology, because remember, I worked at Cisco and I worked at LinkedIn. So we had those tools and we had those platforms, you know, Microsoft Teams, they're all great teams. But what had changed was the way of working gave the teams permission to, you know, post this work in progress, because we had to, you had to make progress. So it was almost like everybody was doing it because we had to. And so I feel like it lifted some of that fear and vulnerability part of it for the teams themselves. And as facilitators, we didn't have a choice, because it was like, look, you got to post your daily updates or we can't make progress on, you know, on our project.
Right. And you can't solve a problem that was coming out of the UAT if you don't know what the problem is. So
exactly.
You couldn't get your work done.
Exactly. And what, you know, because of the facilitation of the tool itself. So, you know, I'm a big proponent of tools, and I'm also tool neutral, but I feel the part of it that changed was the employee engagement. The fact that they had not permission to, you know, talk about work in progress. That was just the way the work was structured. We structured it that way. You know, every day you give these updates. And so, you know, I would still write an executive summary, but it came from the people and the teams doing the work. And, you know, after a while, it was just easier to, you know, read the updates instead of having me do, you know, I did do a weekly presentation, but that's what really changed for me, was that we were given permission. It was okay with it. It was the way people worked. People were comfortable with it because they had to, because of the pandemic. But why did it take that for us to realize that it's okay to share work in progress, right?
Yeah, so I mean, what it did was it actually debatched the updates, right? So when you're doing a big report out, you're basically batching all of the updates.
Yes.
Which gives you a chance, you know, there's some benefit to that, because you can see relationships and
yes,
you know,
yes,
that you might not see otherwise if you're getting things in, so actually in single piece flow. But by moving away from that batching, then you're creating an expectation, right? That everybody's doing it. We're all comfortable. You have lots of opportunities to see that nobody's getting in trouble for it.
Yes.
Right? Because that's the other thing with a big batch of updates, you know, we did a week's worth of work and now here's a week's worth of updates all, you know, in a 30-page PowerPoint deck. Is that reduces the number of opportunities for you to actually have that interaction with the sponsors to see how the sponsors are going to react. And you can build up all those stories in your head about what might happen or what you might get in trouble for, or, you know, how you might, you know, you might have been up showing that your process wasn't so great before, so perhaps your performance wasn't so good before, maybe you get in trouble for that, or you know, or whatever the issue is. So it's giving many, many more opportunities for people just to have that experience of saying, hey, it's not so bad, it's not so bad, it's not so bad, it's actually, it's quite good. Well, no, right. Look, it's actually right. Really good.
Right, we're making progress. Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's the concept of the fast feedback, maybe, versus, you know, waiting until the very end, and the team vulnerability of, you know, and I do have to say that not 100% of the people were comfortable posting in the Teams. I still had a couple of holdouts that would like email me their updates because, you know, they wanted to remain anonymous or something. But as for me, as a kind of like the project facilitator, I felt afterwards, you know, thinking back on it, I was like, wow, you know, we should have just put that into our format in the first place, right? You know, anyway, for me, it's just a learning. It's like, I'm not going back to the old way of doing my own report outs, Bella. I need to, you know, I like this part of the employees telling the story, you know? And I just feel like I've really learned that part of it. And, you know, that's just something that, you know, for me, I think should work. It works better. I believe it does, because the updates are coming from the people doing the work. And that's the important part of Kaizen, right?
Right, right. And that's, yeah, because Kaizen really should be daily improvement. So now you're really seeing that.
Yes.
That's great. Yeah, and so that does make you really think about, okay, what have we done with structure? What have we done with telling people they have to have a green belt book or a black belt book? And, you know, all of that stuff, have we actually, you know, tripped ourselves up with this? And we need to be thinking about, how do we do this in a way we are making smaller batches or whatever it is that we're doing, you know, single piece flow of our progress.
Yeah,
which is kind of an agile concept, but it's,
yes.
I think, it's not saying to people, you've got to go to all like months and months of agile training and learn all of the things about how you do sprints and everything. It's just, you know, we're going to do this every day now.
Right.
That's our expectation. That's really cool.
I think when one of your podcasts was related to a pilot, and your comment to him was that he was doing the improvement work every day. And I think that's what I felt with the, you know, with these teams is that they're doing the work, they're doing in the improvements. And then they will even say things like, well, I just don't know what to call it. And it's like, just call it improvements. I mean, you know, what, it doesn't have to have the fancy term, you know, for it.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I think for me, just, you know, we really have to challenge ourselves as practitioners, as facilitators to, you know, that I'm not trying to rewrite the book on, you know, lean, or definitely we know the tools and we love the tools, we use the tools. What I'm saying is that because of the fact that we are empowering teams, if we really believe that we should be empowering teams, then we need to think about better ways to make sure that it really is about the team, you know, and not about us or our outcome. Not that it's about us, you know, any of us as practitioners, Bella, we want the tools to succeed because we truly do believe them, right? And so, but if we really want to believe that it's about employee engagement, that's the part of it that I think was the biggest learning for me this past year.
Was the employee engagement.
Yeah.
So when you think about that, Peggy, if you were to have a new belt candidate come along and you were going to start training them now, what would be your words of wisdom? If you wanted them to remember one thing from Peggy that stuck in their head, what would you want them to know?
Well, I think for me, because my path may not have been a straight, direct line, it was more of a zigzag. It's like, oh, I think I'll go into financial services. Oh, no, you know what? I really like tech, but I'll probably go back to financial services. Oh, no, I really like tech, but you know what? Maybe I'll try this consulting thing for a while. And so, you know, what I would say is that just because you're on a path right now doesn't mean you have to stay on that path. That's the first thing that I have learned. Reinventing yourself and change is hard. But I believe, you know, as practitioners, we learn about these, you know, change processes and the tools to help support that change. So, you know, I'm not saying just change for the sake of changing, you know, you can be thoughtful about it. And I just, you know, one of the things that I've learned again, recently is that, you know, I think you have to be authentic to yourself and, you know, what you're trying to, you know, to do. We're part of a huge, fabulous professional work network. And, you know, my colleagues that I've met in my career are some of, you know, some very good friends of mine as well, right? But even within then, each one of us did it a little bit differently, right? And we learned from each other. So I would say, you know, yeah, you know, learn the discipline, whatever discipline it is that you're choosing. But stay true to what you're trying to do. And then don't be afraid to pivot, because, you know, that can happen too. And you can still be successful.
Right. Yeah. And I think your story that you've just shared with us about did it all this way all these years, and now suddenly learn
something different.
Yeah, do something different. It's you know, it's really good. So be true to yourself, but be ready to parrot. I love it. So thank you, Peggy. This has been a great conversation, and I think it's going to be very helpful to all the rest of the practitioners out there who are struggling with similar issues. So
thanks,
I really
Bella.
Appreciate
it. And again, yeah, you know, if people have ideas, I am always open to new ideas and continuous learning. So I would love to hear from people in terms of, you know, what they've learned and what they're doing differently or what worked for them. I'm always open to new ideas. So
what's the best way to contact you?
The best way to contact me is through LinkedIn, of course, because I'm a LinkedIn alumni. So I'll put that little plug in there. I did have a talk about change. I got married last year. So you can find me at Peggy Fry Barnes on LinkedIn. That would be great. I would love to hear from people.
Okay, so Peggy wants to hear from you. Thanks very much, Peggy.
Thanks, Bella.
This is Bella Ankbuck, and I'd like to thank Peggy Fry Barnes for being my guest on The Edges of Lean. How are you improving your improvement practice? Let Peggy and me know. Please join me in exploring more of The Edges of Lean. There's a lot to learn. And check out leancommunicators.com. That's where you'll find more great podcasts and videos from the continuous improvement community. The Edges of Lean is written and produced by Bella Engelbein. This is a Lean for Humans production.